heard, referring to someone she might have spoken to that afternoon or maybe 5 years earlier, a shop clerk, a neighbor, talking to me that way, like that, like I'm nothing. She doesn't know it, but I could buy and sell her. Fly home for a visit and you'd find her in the kitchen, slamming around, replaying some argument she'd had with our father. Goddamn bastard, shove it up your ass, why don't you? You and your stinking, why hire a plumber when I can do it myself? You can't do it yourself, you hear me, buddy? You can't. Late in her life, my mother embraced the word fuck, but could never quite figure out its place in a sentence. So I said to him, I don't give a damn fuck what you do with it. Just get it the hell out of my driveway. By that point in the evening, she'd look different, raw, like you'd taken the lady she was earlier and peeled her. The loafers she favored would have been kicked off, and she'd be in her stocking feet, hands on the counter to steady herself as she raged. She was hardly ever angry at the person she was talking to, exceptions being my brother Paul, my father, and my sister Tiffany. Rather, she'd be looking for support. Can you believe this shit? I mean, can you? We didn't dare contradict her. I have an English friend named Ingrid, and her father was an alcoholic. When he lost his license for driving drunk, he got himself a tricycle and would pedal it back and forth to a pub, everyone in the village watching. Not a regular bike, I asked. He would have fallen off, Ingrid told me, relieved to be at the stage where she could laugh about it. Her father was a horrible person, a mean clown, which makes it easier, in a way. Our mother did nothing so cartoonish, and if she had, we'd have felt traitorous making fun of her. Instead, we separated her into two people and discounted what the second, drunk one did, for that wasn't really her, we reasoned, but a kind of virus talking. Her father had it, too, and drank until men in white coats carted him off to the state hospital where he received shock treatments. I look at pictures of him after his release and think, wait, that's me. We didn't resemble each other when I was young, but now we could be twins. The big moment on intervention is when family and friends of the alcoholic or drug addict confront him or her. It's supervised by a counselor and often takes place in a sad hotel conference room with flesh-colored furniture and no windows. The addicts are usually in full blossom, drunk or high or on the nod. What the hell? They say, looking around at their parents, their brothers and sisters, their wives or husbands, all together, seated in a semicircle. The subjects of the intervention already feel ambushed, so steps are taken to keep them from feeling attacked as well. It's easy to lose one's temper in this situation, so the counselor has instructed the friends and family members to organize their thoughts on paper. The letters they read are never wholly negative and usually kick off with a pleasant memory. I remember when you were brought home from the hospital is a big one. This is the equivalent of a short story beginning with the main character's alarm clock going off, and though I know I shouldn't get hung up on this part of the show, I do. Oh, please, I think, rolling my eyes as the combative meth addict is told, you had a smile that could light up a room. The authors of the letters often cry, perhaps because what they've written is so poorly constructed. Then again, reality TV is fueled by tears. Take another of the shows I like, My 600-Pound Life, about morbidly obese people struggling with their weight. At the start of each program, loved ones appear, always weeping, always saying the exact same thing. I don't want to have to bury my own child, slash, sister, slash, nephew, etc. Yes, well, I wouldn't either, I think. If digging the grave didn't do me in, I'd surely die trying to roll that massive body into it. There's crying on hoarders as well, though rarely by the pack rat, who sees no downside to saving all his used toilet paper. After everyone on intervention has had their say, the addicts are offered a spot in a rehab center. Not all of them accept, but most do. The places they're sent to tend to be sunny, Arizona, Southern California, Florida. We see them 2 months into their stay, most looking like completely different people. Here are the wind chimes I made in my arts and crafts group, the woman who earlier in the program was seen shooting speed into her neck. says. Not everyone stays the prescribed 90 days. Some leave early and relapse. Others get out on schedule and relapse a week or 6 months later. The hardiest of them are revisited several years down the line, still sober, many with jobs now and children. All that time I wasted, they say. What on earth was I thinking? I asked Ingrid once if she ever talked to her father about his drinking, and I think she was ashamed to answer no. Not that I or anyone in my family ever confronted my mother, no matter how bad it got. Even my dad, who's super direct and tells complete strangers that they're loud or wrong or too fat for that bolero jacket, said nothing. Then again, it built so gradually. For as long as I was living at home, it never seemed a problem. It was only after 5 of her 6 children had left that she upped her quota. The single scotch before dinner became 2, and then 3. Her wine intake doubled, tripled. She was never a quality drinker. Quantity was what mattered. She bought jugs, not bottles. After dinner, she'd switch to coffee, and then back to scotch or wine, supplementing the alcohol with pills. Mom's dolls, we called them. When she told us that she would no longer drive at night, that she couldn't see the road, we all went along with it, knowing the real reason was that by sunset she was in no shape to get behind the wheel. Gosh, we said, we hope that doesn't happen to our eyes when we're your age. In that respect, you have to hand it to the family members on intervention. Corny letters notwithstanding, they have guts. The person they're confronting might storm out of the room and never talk to them again, but at least they're rolling the dice. Though we never called our mother on her behavior, she knew that we noticed it. I haven't had a drink in 4 days, she'd announce out of nowhere, usually over the phone. You could hear the struggle and the hope in her voice. I'd call her the next night and could tell right away that she'd lost her willpower. Why aren't you stronger? I wanted to ask. I mean, really, can't you just try harder? Of course, I was drunk too, so what could I say? I suppose I felt that my youth made it less sad. The vast plain of adulthood stretched before me while she was well into her 50s, drinking alone in a house filled with crap. Even sober, she'd rail against that, all the junk my father dragged home and left in the yard or the basement, old newspapers and magazines, toaster ovens picked out of the trash, hoses, sheets of plywood, all of it perfectly good, all of it just what he needed. In my mind, our house used to be so merry. There was music playing in every room, the phone was always ringing. People in my family laughed more than people in other families. I was as sure of that as I was of anything. Up and down the street, our neighbors left their dinner tables as soon as they could and beat it for the nearest TV. That's what my father did, while the rest of us stayed put with our mother, vying for her attention as the candles burned down. Group therapy, she called it, though it was more like a master class. One of us would tell a story about our day, and she'd interject every now and then to give notes. You don't need all that detail about the bedroom, she'd say, or maybe it's best to skip the part about the teacher and just cut to the chase. Pour me a cup of coffee, she'd say, come 10 o'clock, our empty plate still in front of us. Get me another pack of Winstons from the pantry, will you? One of the perks of having 6 kids was that you didn't have to locate anything on your own. Find my car keys, she'd command, or someone get me a pair of shoes. There was never a rebellion because it was her asking. Pleasing our mother was fun and easy and made us feel good. I'll light her cigarette. No, I will. Maybe ours wasn't the house I'd have chosen had I been in charge of things. It wasn't as clean as I'd have liked. From the outside, it wasn't remarkable. We had no view. But still, it was the place I held in mind, and proudly, when I thought home. It had been a living organism, but by the time I hit my late 20s, it was rotting, a dead tooth in a row of seemingly healthy ones. When I was 11, my father planted a line of olive bushes in front of the house. They were waist-high and formed a kind of fence. By the mid-80s, they were so overgrown that pedestrians had to quit the sidewalk and take to the street instead. People with trash to drop waited until they reached our yard to drop it, figuring the high grass would cover whatever beer can or plastic bag of dog shit they needed to discard. It was like the Addams Family house, which would have been fine had it still been Mary, but it wasn't anymore. Our mother became the living ghost that haunted it, gaunt now and rattling ice cubes instead of chains. I'd come home from Chicago where I was living, and she would offer to throw a dinner party for my friends. "Invite the Sieglers," she'd say, and, "Hey, Dean," or, "Lynn, I haven't seen her in a while." She was lonely for company, so I'd pick up the phone. By the time my guests arrived, she'd be wasted. My friends all noticed it. How could they not? Sitting at the table as she repeated a story for the third time, I got them laughing. Watching as she stumbled, as the ash of her cigarette fell onto the floor, I'd cringe and then feel guilty for being embarrassed by her. Had I not once worn a top hat to meet her at the airport, a top hat and suspenders, with red platform shoes? I was 17 that year, but still, and how many times had I been drunk or high at the table? Wasn't it maybe my turn to be the embarrassed one? Must remain loyal, I'd think. The morning after a dinner party, her makeup applied but still in her robe, my mother would be sheepish. "Well, it was nice to see Dean again." That would have been the perfect time to sit her down, to say, "Do you remember how out of control you were last night? What can we do to help you?" I'm forever thinking of all our missed opportunities, 6 kids and a husband, and not one of us spoke up. I imagine her at a rehab center in Arizona or California, a state she'd never been to. "Who knew I'd be so good at pottery?" I can hear her saying, and "I'm really looking forward to rebuilding my life." Sobriety would not have stopped the cancer that was quietly growing inside her, but it would have allowed her to hold her head up, to recall what it felt like to live without shame, if only for a few years. "Do you think it was my fault that she drank?" my father asked not long ago. It's the assumption of an amateur, someone who stops after his second vodka tonic and quits taking his pain medication before the prescription runs out. It's almost laughable, this insistence on a reason. I think my mother was lonely without her children, her fan club. But I think she drank because she was an alcoholic. "How can you watch that crap?" he would say whenever he walked into the house on Maui and caught me in front of intervention. "Well, I'm not only watching it," I'd tell him. "I'm also signing my name." This was never enough for him. "You're in Hawaii, sitting indoors in the middle of the day. Get out of here, why don't you? Get some sun." And so I'd put on my shoes and take a walk, never on the beach, but along the road or through residential neighborhoods. I saw a good deal of trash. Cans, bottles, fast food wrappers, the same junk I see in England. I saw flattened cane toads with tire treads on them. I saw small birds with brilliant red heads. One afternoon, I pushed an SUV that had stalled in traffic. The driver was perhaps in his mid-20s and was talking on the phone when I offered a hand. He nodded, so I took up my position at the rear and remembered after the first few yards what a complete pain in the ass it is to help someone in need. I thought he'd just steer to the curb, but instead he went another 100 or so feet down the road where he turned the corner. "Does he expect me to push him all the way home?" I asked myself, panting. Eventually he pulled over and put on the brake. The guy never thanked me or even put down his phone. "Asshole," I thought. Back at the house, I took another stack of papers and started signing my name to them. "That's not your signature," Hugh said, frowning over my shoulder. "It's what's become of my signature," I told him, looking at the scrawl in front of me. You could sort of make out a D and an S, but the rest was like a silhouette of a mountain range or a hospital patient's medical chart just before he's given the bad news. In my defense, it never occurred to me that I'd be signing my name 5,000 times, in the course of my entire life maybe, but not in one shot. This was not the adulthood that I had predicted for myself, an author of books, spending a week in Hawaii with his handsome, longtime boyfriend before deciding which house to return to. I had wished for it, sure, but I'd also wished for a complete head transplant. Hugh had made himself a Manhattan and was sitting on the patio with my manuscript. A minute passed, then two, then five. "Why aren't you laughing?" I called. I was living in New York, still broke and unpublished, when my mother died. Aside from the occasional Sidney Sheldon novel, she wasn't a reader, so she didn't understand the world I was fluttering around the edges of. If she thought it was hopeless or that I was wasting my time writing, she never said as much. My father, on the other hand, was more than happy to predict a dismal future. Perhaps it was despite him that she supported us in our far-fetched endeavors, art school for me and Gretchen, Amy at Second City. Just when we needed money, at the moment before we had to ask for it, checks would arrive. "A little something to see you through," the accompanying notes would read. "Love, your old mother." Was she sober in those moments, I wondered, signing my name to another sheet of paper? Was it with a clear mind that she believed in us, or was it just the booze talking? The times I miss her most are when I see something she might have liked, a piece of jewelry or a painting, the view of a white sand beach off a balcony, palm trees. How I'd have loved to spoil her with beautiful things. On one of her last birthdays, I gave her a wasp's nest that I'd found in the woods. It was all I could afford, a nursery that bugs made and left behind. "I'll get you something better later," I promised. "Of course you will," she said, reaching for her glass. "And whatever it is, I'm sure I'm going to love it." I'm still standing. In the spring of 2017, a passenger seated two rows ahead of me on a plane to Denver shit in his pants. He was old, but not ancient. Early 80s, maybe, and was traveling with a middle-aged woman I took to be his daughter. "Oh, no," I heard her moan. The man responded with something I couldn't catch, and the woman, who was on her feet now, threw up her hands. "Well, I'd say it's a little more than an accident." As the guy shuffled toward the bathroom, I lowered my eyes, the way I hope my fellow passengers will do when it's my turn to soil myself on a crowded airplane. For surely that day is coming. One late morning, the person who's causing everyone to gag will be me. Teenagers will laugh, and as they raise their phones to take my picture from behind, their parents, to no avail, will scold them. The walk of shame, I call it. For it's not the first time I've seen someone slog from their now-ruined seat to the bathroom. A few years back, it was a woman, very nicely dressed, at least in my opinion. She looked like she'd taken her clothes off a long-dead gypsy whose grave she had just now unearthed. And I smiled as she approached, thinking I would say to her, "What an interesting skirt." Then she drew closer and, well... The man who'd shit in his pants went into the bathroom and stayed there, no doubt looking for something to kill himself with. When my turn comes, I'm thinking I'll smash my glasses and open a vein with one of the shards. Because there's no coming back from a thing like that. It doesn't matter that you'll never see these people again. Even if the plane were to go down, and everyone on it but you were to die instantly, you'd never really recover.
Sir?
15 minutes after the man entered the bathroom, one of the flight attendants began knocking on the door.
Sir, we're preparing to land. I'm afraid you need to come out and return to your seat.
She knocked again.
Sir, are you all right?
For God's sake, leave him alone. I wanted to say, it isn't fair to make him come out and walk past us all another time. Just let him be. The flight attendant either came to her senses and stopped harassing him, or after leaving the bathroom, the man took a seat on the back row. All I know is that I never saw him again. He was on my mind, though. A few weeks after that flight, I was in Dallas, having lunch with my young friend, Kimberly, when all of a sudden, I didn't feel very well. Came out of nowhere. A nausea that caused me to lose my appetite and perspire, though I wasn't particularly hot. I knew of a place not far from here that serves the most amazing pie, Kimberly said. Are you up for a slice? Maybe with some ice cream? I didn't want to say that I wasn't feeling well. It ruins everyone's good time. Besides, I thought, since when has pie made anything worse? Back at my hotel, an hour or so later, I lay on my bed for a while, then raced to the bathroom. I don't know where I'd gotten it from, but I seemed to have contracted a pretty serious gastrointestinal virus. Unfortunately, I had a show to do. 2,000 people were expecting me to pull myself together, get dressed, and stand in front of them for an hour and a half, so that's what I did. It was the first time in my memory that I read while sitting down. The hope was that the pressure of my body might keep everything in, and it was threatening at any moment to gush out. By this point, it was like rusty water. What seemed to be a paint can's worth every time. For 90 minutes, all I thought of was how shitting in my pants in front of that many people was going to feel. Not that it requires a great deal of imagination. It helped, I suppose, that I was behind a podium and that the front row was a good 20 feet away. On the other side of the orchestra pit, audience might never need to know. I'd have to kill the entire stage crew, though. Including poor Kimberly, who was standing in the wings with a bucket in her hands. A bucket. And was the only person I had talked to about my condition. One of the things I thought of that evening, for it is entirely possible to think of other things and even to do math while reading out loud, was my friend Andy. A few months earlier, he told me that when he was 16 and in his then girlfriend's rec room with three of their fellow high school students, he started feeling queasy. I think it was food poisoning from some stuffed shells I'd eaten, he said. I was sweating, my stomach started churning, and just as I stood up to run to the bathroom, it poured out of me. Oh, my God, I said. We were at his house eating dinner with his wife and two adolescent daughters who had heard the story before but could clearly hear it again every day for the rest of their lives. I mean, their dad shitting in his pants. That's gold. I had to borrow clothes from my girlfriend's brother, Andy told us, his head in his hands, still haunted. Not that he ever wanted them back. The relationship was over the moment I let loose on her family's carpet. That's the kind of thing that would scar a person for life. It's like Carrie level. How are you still not in therapy, I asked. I mean, it's only been, what, 30 years? Andy was in front of four other people, I thought, turning the page and looking up briefly from the podium. Multiply that by 500.
After the reading, there was an equally precarious book signing. Did you ever meet people who have a gastrointestinal virus? I asked the woman after learning that she was a nurse. Oh, yes, she told me. And what do you recommend they do? Well, there's not much you can do, really, she said. Drink plenty of fluids, something with electrolytes like Gatorade, rest. You probably don't feel like eating, but you should force yourself to get something down. That's all I can tell you. I hoped that by the following morning I'd be back to normal, but there was no change. I'd gotten up 3 times during the night and was still passing a paint can's worth of rusty water every 2 hours or so. Where on earth is this coming from, I wonder? My eyes? Do I have great stores of liquid hidden in my neck? My calves? I had to go to Des Moines, so put an extra pair of dark slacks in my carry-on tote bag, just in case the worst happened during the flight. I thought of picking up a ski mask as well. That's what you really need, something to conceal your identity as you make the walk of shame. But in this day and age, on a plane, ski mask would only get you tackled. This while you're already nauseated and plastered with your own feces. The thing about a stomach virus is that it exhausts you. Brushing my teeth wore me out. When it came time to put on my shoes, all I could do was stare down at them and whimper. At the airport, I wanted nothing more than to rest. I couldn't, though, because I had my Fitbit to consider. That and the Apple Watch I wear right above it on the same wrist. Every night it sends me a notice congratulating me on my longest running move streak. I'd met all my requirements, standing time, exercise minutes, and calories burned for 360 days, and there was no way I was going to ruin my perfect record. The minimum for my Fitbit is 4.5 miles, but for my watch it's closer to 7, hardly an unreasonable distance unless, like me, even standing upright was a challenge. Yet still, after checking my suitcase, I put one foot in front of the other and dragged myself from Terminal A to D and back. Must meet Fitbit and watch requirements. I moaned between clenched teeth, staggering forward. Must be mentally and physically ill at the same time. 2 miles later, I boarded my flight and put what little energy I had back into fearing I might shit in my pants in front of a plane full of people. How is this my life? I asked myself. As I settled into my seat with a bottle of Gatorade, perhaps the greatest indignity of all. What flavor is that? The man beside me asked. I looked at the bottle. Blue? For that's all Gatorade ever tastes like. It's color. Over the period that I had my stomach virus, I tried them all. Blue, red, green, yellow, orange, and a new opaque one that tasted opaque. One of my watch's more irritating features is an hourly reminder to get off my ass. I'll often be at the podium toward the end of a show and feel what amounts to a light tap on my wrist, followed by a message, time to stand up. What do you think I've been doing for the last 80 minutes, I want to shout, wondering where it gets its information from. The watch is seemingly calibrated to whichever plane I'm on. So the moment we hit turbulence or are instructed to prepare for a landing, I can expect the tap. Please sit down and fasten your seatbelts, the flight attendant says. Stand up. and be my crazy slave. The watch counters. I realized not long ago that if I put my hands in front of me and rub the palms together for a minute, the way I might if I were cold or were watching a very slow waiter bring something to my table that I was really looking forward to, I can fool the watch and be rewarded with a "Congratulations, you did it" message. Some would call this cheating, but on an average day, I far exceed my standing goal. So in my mind, I'm covered. Plus, I only rub my hands together when traveling. At home, when instructed to stand, I do something useful. Empty the scrap bucket into the compost bin. Hang a few shirts on the clothesline. Did you just do a load of laundry? You will ask. No, I tell him. I just wanted to leave my desk and get a few steps in. Those shirts are dirty. At home, I can adhere more strictly to my beloved routine, which has always been very important to me. More important than anything, I used to think. Then touring came along, a.k.a. money, and I decided I could maybe learn to wing it for a while. In an average year, I might spend 3.5 months on the road, more if I have a new book out. Does Hugh come with you? People regularly ask. No, I tell him. I mean, he'd like to, but what with his wheelchair, it would be pretty hard. The person who asks then nods respectfully, no doubt sorry that he or she brought it up. I have to wash him and feed him and get him in and out of bed. Takes a great deal of time, so when I'm away, I hire someone to do all that for me. Another understanding nod. Sometimes I leave it at that, and sometimes I admit that I'm kidding and explain that Hugh has better things to do than accompany me to Des Moines. I'm just surprised that you believe the wheelchair business, I say. Not that there's anything wrong with being a quadriplegic, but given all the times I've mentioned Hugh in print, being paralyzed from the neck down is a pretty big thing to leave out, don't you think? At home, when I get sick or injured, Hugh will usually insist that it's all in my mind. Either that or he'll blame me for it. That was the case when I fell off a ladder. It was Christmas Day, and as I lay on the floor, unable to move or even speak, he stood over me shouting, "Why are you wearing those pants?" As if the legs were sewn together. And were the reason I had fallen. "You look like an idiot. And with that shirt, I don't even know who you are anymore." Is now really the moment to get into all this, I wondered? Fairly certain that my back was broken. The time before that, though, he was so kind. This preceded the ladder incident and also took place in Sussex. It was early December, and I was on my daily walk, perhaps 7 miles from home, when I understood that something was wrong. My stomach didn't ache exactly. Rather, it let its presence be known. Then I felt a sudden loss of energy, as if someone had reached inside me and yanked out my batteries. The owner of the house I was in front of had placed large rocks on either side of his driveway and painted them white. The biggest was maybe 6 inches tall. It was uncomfortable to sit on, but I did. And a few moments later, I vomited, grateful that it was almost dark and raining and that no one could see me. Then I did it again, thinking this might be the only vomit in all of England that had no traces of alcohol in it. A novelty, but nevertheless unsightly. And so I covered it up with leaves before struggling to my feet. Hugh's piano teacher lived a few houses away from the rock I'd been sitting on. It wasn't a great distance, but weak as I was, it took a while to reach her front door, then to form a fist and knock on it. Her husband kindly gave me a ride home, where I found Hugh in his studio and vomited some more. "Wow," he said. "You're really sick." He helped me into the house and upstairs to our bed. Then he brought me a bell that I rang every 10 or so minutes for the next 16 hours. "Can I have some water? I think I need a glass of ginger ale." "We don't have any." "I bet the store does." "Bring me my iPad, my laptop, the memoir in my office by a man who had both his feet chewed off by a panda cub." "You couldn't find such a book?" "Maybe I dreamt it. Where's that tea I asked for? Can you change my socks for me?" I thought of Hugh quite often during the period that I had my stomach virus. He doesn't like to talk on the phone, and it's a mistake to push him on it. He'll settle for an email and a pinch, but what Hugh wants when I'm away are letters with stamps on them. If they're patched together entries from my diary, he can tell, and we'll stop reading. So I have to sit down with the express intent of addressing him and only him. I sometimes resent the time it takes, but then I picture him at home taking the letter from Phil, our mailman, and laying it on the kitchen table. He won't read it right away. Rather, he'll prepare for it, sitting in the garden if it's dry, or in his studio if it's not. He'll have a cup of coffee or tea and maybe a biscuit. He's just whipped up, everything just so. The way I am if a New Yorker arrives with a story by Laurie Moore in it. Then I'll think of the way he eats dinner when I'm not there, of how he'll spoon the juices of whatever he prepared over the meat or fish and arrange things attractively on his plate. When I'm alone, I'll sometimes eat directly out of the pans with my fingers to save myself from having to wash a fork or a dish. But not Hugh. He always sets the table before sitting down. If it's chilly, he'll build a fire in the kitchen fireplace, and the flames will reflect off his wine glass. Then he'll light candles and eat with the same manners he'd use if invited to Buckingham Palace, a cloth napkin on his lap, not watching a show on his computer or reading anything, but just staring forward at the place where I would be if I were home. Whenever I get tired of having to write him letters, I think of that, him eating alone, and pick up my pen. "Dear Hugh." While sick, I wrote that I wasn't feeling well. I said I worried I might shit in my pants on a plane or while standing at the podium. But even that was testing his limits. Unlike a friend of my brother, who's been known to take pictures of his bowel movements, Hugh and I never discuss what goes on in the bathroom. I have no evidence he's ever done anything in there but brush his teeth and soak in the tub. He won't even let me in when he's peeing. "I had that in my mouth 10 minutes ago. And now it's a private part?" I'll call from the other side of the door. "Yes, go away." If I'd had the gastrointestinal virus at home, I might have said, "I was in the bathroom a lot today." I could have spoken about my nausea and general lack of energy, but that would be the extent of it. I wouldn't use the word diarrhea, as it would be too indelicate. We're well matched in our prudishness. The difference is that while I might not go into detail about myself, I'm more than happy to talk about someone else. This young man I met, for instance, whose girlfriend put her feet up on the dashboard of his truck and accidentally shit in her cutoff shorts. I guess she got a little too relaxed, the guy told me. I don't want to hear this, you said, when I repeated the story. We weren't eating or anything, but even if we were, I wouldn't have understood his objection. This happened years ago, I explained. Thousands of miles away from here. That doesn't matter, he told me. I'm not interested. But no. My gastrointestinal virus lasted for 6 long days, each of which involved at least one flight and an appearance before an audience. Halfway through it, the cramps arrived, some so severe they doubled me over. I thought of my insides as a haunted house with bolts of lightning ricocheting off the walls. The worst of them came when I was in Austin, Texas, walking along a path behind my hotel that ran beside the river. I was trying to get my steps in. And as I stood there, legs crossed, my eyes screwed shut against the pane, it occurred to me that if the floodgates did open, which seemed highly probable, I'd have to jump into the water. Getting out again, wet, covered in mud, I'd likely wish I weren't staying in such a nice hotel. At the La Quinta Inn, you might return to your room unnoticed. But there was no way I could sop through the lobby of the Four Seasons without causing a fuss. A child was drowning. And I jumped into the river to save her, I could say. Don't worry, she's fine now. I just need to go up and change out of these wet clothes. Would they buy it, I wondered, looking out at the brown water? Do I look like the type who could save a child? Should I add more detail? Say, perhaps, that the girl was Mexican? These are the questions you ask yourself when you're traveling with a gastrointestinal virus. Then one day you wake up, normal, restored to health, a miracle. At first you're incredibly grateful, your appetite's back, your energy level. There's a bit of you, though, that misses the razor's edge. The terrible thrill that at any moment you might lose control of yourself and finally know what total disgrace feels like. I'll wager that it's so far from near total disgrace as to be incomprehensible for a while, the difference, say, between a toothache and being burned alive. I think of that man in the airplane bathroom. The flight attendant knocks, thinking he has his trousers off and is trying to rinse them in that worthless little sink. But he's still fully dressed. And looking in the mirror, shocked that he could feel so fundamentally different, yet still have human features, let alone the same face. The two eyes right where they were the last time he checked. That same nose and mouth. But how can this be, he wonders. Sir, the woman on the other side of the door says. Sir, you have to come out now. Sir, are you all right? When it's my turn, I'll open my mouth, unable to speak, and feel a little tap on my wrist. Time to stand up, my watch will whisper. Then, before killing myself, I'll say one last time, I am standing up. Thank you.
The spirit world. Our house on Emerald Isle is divided down the middle and has an E beside one front door and a W beside the other. The east side is ruled by Hugh, and the bedroom we share is on the top floor. It opens onto a deck that overlooks the ocean and is next to Amy's room, which is the same size as ours, but is shaped differently. Unlike Lisa and Paul, who were on the west side of the house and could probably sleep on burlap without noticing it, Amy likes nice sheets. She'd packed a new set in her suitcase and on the night before Thanksgiving, as I helped her make her bed, she mentioned a friend who'd come to her apartment for dinner the previous evening in New York. "He drinks Coke, right? So I went to the store on the corner to buy some," she said. "And you know how those new bottles have names on the labels, Blake or Kelly or whatever?" I nodded. "Well, there were only two left on the shelf. One with Mom printed on it, and the other with Tiffany." I reached for a pillowcase. "Do you think if I were dead, there would have been three bottles on the shelf instead of two, and the third would have had my name on it?" Amy thought for a moment. "Yes." "So the only Cokes at that store in New York City are for people in our family who have died?" She smoothed out the bedspread. "Yes." I couldn't tell if she honestly believed this. It's hard to say with Amy. On the one hand, she's very pragmatic, and on the other, she's open to just about anything. Astrology, for instance. I wouldn't call her a nut exactly, but she has paid good money to have her chart done, and if you're talking about someone, she'll often ask when this person's birthday is, and then say something like, "Ah, a Gemini. Okay, that makes sense now." She's big on acupuncture as well, which I also tend to think is dubious, at least for things like allergies. That said, I admire people who are curious and open their minds to new possibilities, especially after a certain age. You have to draw the line somewhere, though, and with me, it's my anus. When I was in my early 30s, it became a thing to have colonics. A number of my friends started going to a man in Chicago and discussing the rubble he'd discovered in their lower intestines. A pumpkin seed, and I haven't eaten pumpkin in 8 years. Their insides were like Pharaoh's tombs, dark catacombs littered with ancient relics. Now people are giving themselves coffee enemas, believing it wards off and even cures cancer. "I think I'll take the cancer, thank you," my sister Lisa said to me on Thanksgiving morning. "Amen to that," I agreed. Lisa's not open to the things that Paul and Amy are, but she has her equivalents. If you told her, for instance, that she was holding her car keys the wrong way, and that there were meetings for people like her, she'd likely attend them for at least 3 months. One of the groups she was going to lately was for mindful eating. "It's not about dieting. We don't believe in that," she said. "You're supposed to carry on as usual, 3 meals a day plus snacks and desserts or whatever. The difference is that now you think about it." She then confessed that the donut she had just finished had been her 6th of the day. "Who brought these?" she asked. I looked at the box and whimpered a little. "Kathy, I think." "God damn her," Lisa whispered. A few weeks before we came to the beach, Amy paid a great deal of money to visit a well-known psychic. The woman has a long waiting list, but someone pulled a few strings, and not long after getting the idea, Amy had her session, which took place over the phone and lasted for an hour. She sent me a brief email after it was over and went into greater detail as we rode with Gretchen from the Raleigh airport to Emerald Isle the day before Thanksgiving. "So start again from the top," I said. "Was it scary?" "It was maybe like calling someone in prison and having one person after another get on the line," she said from the back seat. "First, I talked to Mom for a while, who's doing well, by the way, and takes credit for setting up you and Hugh. Then Tiffany appeared." I ripped open a bag of almonds. "Yeah, right." "Ordinarily, I'd be like that too," Amy said, "but the psychic's voice changed after Mom went away. She sounded tough all of a sudden and started by saying, 'I really don't feel like talking to you right now. This is a favor, okay?'" Tiffany thanked Amy for cleaning up the mess she'd left after she committed suicide. "That's strange," I said. "I mean, how would the psychic have known anything about that?" Amy sat up and moved closer so that her head was between my seat and Gretchen's. "I know. She said that Tiffany had tried to kill herself before, also true, and that she always knew she was going to do this. The only question was when. It was crazy how much she got right." "Your sister was mentally ill," she said, "possibly bipolar, and stopped taking her medication because she didn't want to dull herself. She said Tiffany felt like everyone was taking from her, using her." "That was certainly true," I said. Most of what Tiffany had to say was directed at you, Amy told me. She wants you to know that the two of you are okay now and that she's not mad anymore. She's not mad, I said. Her. I'm the one who had reason to be mad. She said she'd misunderstood you and that lately she's been working on herself. You have to work on yourself after you're dead? I asked. It seemed a bit much, like having to continue a diet or your participation in AA. I thought that death let you off the hook when it came to certain things, that it somehow purified you. Tiffany's been hanging out a lot with Mom's dad, Grandpa Leonard, Amy told me. This made me furious for some reason, but she didn't even know him. I guess they met there, Amy said. And where is that? Amy shrugged. I don't know. It's not like you can ask 1,000 questions and get them answered. They tell you what they want to tell you, and you just listen. I tried to let that sink in. She and Mom are finally getting along, Amy continued. She mainly wanted to let you know that she has no hard feelings. The psychic said Tiffany's been trying to tell you this herself and asked if you've had a lot of problems with your phone lately. No. Power outages? Again, I said no. What about butterflies? Are you serious? I asked. Our house last winter was loaded with them. I've never seen anything like it. In the summer, fine, but this was crazy. Hugh and I talked about it every day. Amy crossed her arms. It was Tiffany. She was trying to contact you. The appointment with the psychic had unnerved the whole family. Tiffany was calmer than normal, but still it was like an actual conversation with her, Amy said. You remember how those were, right? We'd be shaking while they were going on. Then we'd think about them for weeks afterward. I remember, Gretchen and I said at the same time. After Tiffany signed off, Amy spoke to an actor she'd known who died of a heroin overdose a few years back, and then to her first serious boyfriend, John Chocontes, who had a brain aneurysm when he was 25. Because she'd had a session so recently, I was welcome to cut to the front of the line and have one of my own the following week. Do you want me to give you the psychic's number? I said nothing. Is that a no? Amy asked. Often, when signing books, I will pretend to have powers. Well, look at the Scorpio, I'll say, when someone approaches my table. I'm just guessing. I wouldn't know a Scorpio from a double Sagittarius. The key I learned is to speak with authority. It's never, are you a Libra? But rather, it's about time I had a Libra up in here. Every now and then, I'll be right, and the person will be shocked. How did you know my sign? They'll ask. The same way I know you have a sister. If I'm right about the sister as well, the person I'm talking to will become like a cat released into a new setting, very low to the ground and suspicious. Who are you talking to? Did one of my friends put you up to this? I met a young woman a few years back, and after being right about both her sign and her sister, I said, as if I were trying to recall something I had dreamed, you were in a hospital earlier this week. Not for yourself, but for someone else. You were visiting someone very close to you. The woman fell apart before my eyes. My mother has cancer. They operated, but how do you... What are you doing? I can't help it, I told her. I know things. I see them. I don't, of course. Those were just guesses. Pulled out of my ass in order to get a rise out of someone. Hugh said the psychic Amy went to did the same thing, but I'm not sure. How would she know what Tiffany sounded like? Looked her up on YouTube, he said. Read one of your stories. These people tell you what you want to hear. It's their way of getting you to come back. There's something about picking the psychic apart that I don't like. It's cynical and uninteresting. That said, I knew I didn't want to book a session. My mother and I were very close, and though I miss her terribly, I'm not sure I need to talk to her again. Since her death, I'd thought of it as an impossibility. Now it felt like a decision, like Mom wants to speak to me, and I'm saying no. But what if she's angry at me for some reason? What would I do with that? As for Tiffany, a few months after she died, a Dutch film crew came to Sussex and followed me around for 3 days. Our conversation was all over the place. We talked about England, writing, life with Hugh. The last hour was shot on a hilltop overlooking my house. The interviewer, a man named Vim, sat beside me. Off camera, he'd mentioned that my sister had recently taken her life. Now he brought it up again. What if you could ask her one question? It seemed like such a television moment, the intimacy unearned, grotesque almost. And so I paused and blinked hard. Then I said, I'd ask, can I have back that money I loaned you? What troubled me most about Amy's talk with the psychic was the notion that the dead are unsettled, that they linger. I said to Lisa at the beach that Thanksgiving, if they can see us from wherever they are, what's to stop them from watching us on the toilet? Lisa took a moment to consider this. I'm guessing that certain places are just off limits. And who would make them off limits, I asked. I don't know, she said. God, maybe? I mean, beats me. We were returning from a walk and came upon our father in the middle of the street, a quarter mile from the house. He was dressed in jeans and had a flat-topped cap on his head. His flannel shirt was untucked, and the tail of it drooped from beneath the hem of his windbreaker. What are you doing here? I asked. Looking for someone, he said. Lisa asked who, and he said he didn't know. I was just hoping somebody might come along and invite me to his house to watch the game. The Panthers are playing this afternoon, and you don't have a goddamn TV. You thought someone was just going to say, hey, why don't you come to my place and watch some football? Lisa asked. I was going to build up to it, my father said. You know, drop hints and so forth. The day after Thanksgiving was bright and unseasonably warm. Hugh made ham sandwiches for lunch, and we ate on the deck. We need to have a code word, so when the next one of us dies, we'll know if the psychic is for real, Amy said. She turned to Dad, the most likely candidate for ceasing to live. What'll yours be? He gave it no thought. Ecstasy. Like the drug? I asked. He picked up his sandwich. What drug? It should be something you say a lot, I told him. Something that would let us know it's really you. Maybe you've gained weight. Or Obama's from Kenya. Those are both three words, Lisa noted. What about Broderson, I said, referring to a North Carolina painter whose work my father collected in the 1970s. Oh, that's perfect, Amy said. I went into the kitchen to get another napkin, and by the time I returned, the topic had changed, and Dad was discussing someone who goes to his gym. The guy is in his 40s and apparently stands too close in the locker room. He undresses me with his eyes, and it makes me uncomfortable, my father said. How does someone undress you with his eyes when you're already undressed? I asked. By that point, what's he looking at? Your soul? On our final evening at the beach over the Thanksgiving weekend, Amy and my niece Madeline usually host a spa night. They dress in uniforms and let it be known beforehand that clients are expected to tip and generously. Facials are given, and Kathy offers foot massages. The treatments feel great, but the best part is listening to Amy, who plays the role of the supervisor. This year, while massaging clay into my father's face, she asked him if he was alone this evening or with his gay lover. I know that a lot of men, such as yourself, also like their testicles waxed, Amy said. If that is of any interest to you, sir, I can get my trainee, Madeline, right on it. Maddie, you up for this? It's so subversive, not just insisting that our father is gay, but that his 12-year-old granddaughter might want to rip the hair off his balls. Before the clay is rubbed into our faces, we're outfitted in shower caps, and afterward, while it dries, we lie back with cucumber slices on our eyes. Paul programs his iPad to play spa music or what passes for music in such places, the sound of a waterfall or rustling leaves, a whale saying something nice to another whale, a harp. This year, I lifted the cucumbers off my eyes and saw Lisa and Dad stretched out like corpses, fast asleep. Paul was out as well, and Gretchen, whose legs were shin deep in the warm, whirling bath, was getting there. It seems there was a perfectly good explanation for all the butterflies in our Sussex house the previous winter. From what I'd read since Amy brought it up, they flew